And welcome to the first episode where we will be exploring the great YOLO Investments Fund and its opportunities here as we go along during 2023. This will be a 12-part series where we'll be interviewing and talking to some of the great founders that belong within the YOLO Investment Group. But today, as the very first episode, we have the general partners with us here today, Julian Behagiar, Tim Heath, and Steve Tsao. And I was thinking, it would be great to start and kickstart off this kind of podcast series to discuss a little bit more with you guys, first of all, of the fund's efforts so far, a turbulent 2022, what are the expectations in 2023, and kind of like when you look at different investment opportunities, what do you look for in a founder, and where are the possibilities and opportunities in 2023? So what do you say, guys? Shall we jump into this straight away?
Let me kick off here, I suppose. Look, I think that the first thing we need to look at is, you know, what's behind YOLO Investments and where it's come from. And obviously, it's been born out of the YOLO Group with its B2C brands, Sportsbet.io and BitCasino, and they've done pretty well over the last 10 years. And we started looking at how to invest into the ecosystem around those B2C brands and really try and create that full circle to support the player journey. And that made us look at sort of B2B opportunities, whether it be in gaming, in slots or live dealer or trading or customer support or accounting software, anything to make our life easier so we can, you know, keep the customer in the center of the universe. But then it also moved into obviously crypto, banking and moving money. And that's really what we're focused on, being the three key areas of fintech, gaming and crypto. And obviously there's a few interesting emerging technologies we like to have a dabble in as well. But we've put a small team together, obviously with Steve and Julian, and we're sort of covering the different geographies around the world, all having had experience as CEOs and all having had many failed businesses, but, you know, a couple of successful ones as well. But like I always say, when we're having an introduction meeting with an asset, potential asset, is our job is to help you avoid the mistakes that we've made, because we've made plenty and we've learnt from them, and strategically advise you how to sort of avoid those pitfalls, but also help you get to market much more quickly, given our distribution and our ecosystem, which I always like to refer back to. So we can help a product get that early product market fit, get the beta testers, an injection in cash flow, which is the most important thing for a startup, through that distribution, and then help guide them through to take the product to the wider market, not just sort of being within the YOLO Group sphere, but also if we're building software or investing into a product, how do we take that to a wider audience? And it's a lot of fun because we can really microscope into details of where a business model may have a problem and find out really quickly and help people pivot and avoid those pitfalls. And you know, you're not waiting to see 3-6 months down the line what's happened. You're getting instant feedback from instant consumers and managers and whatnot to understand what works and doesn't work. So it's slightly different to a typical investment fund or venture capitalist, because we like to be very, very hands-on. But at the same time, it's about investing into the people behind the product and making sure we allow them to achieve their dreams or certainly strive for them. And we're just there to sort of fine-tune that thinking process.
Just to add here, we like inserting ourselves at one of the early stages in a company's life cycle. Tends to be around the post-product, probably pre-revenue, or maybe just slightly after they've made their first dollar. And the USP we add on top of that is then we help them scale to a point where we either hand them over to a bigger VC or a bigger private equity firm, or actually take them to a point of exit, which could be a sale, could be a merger, could be an acquisition, or even an IPO. So we like
could getting involved.
Could be, well, in 2021, definitely.
Times have changed a little bit.
I think it's safe to say we're all SPAC allergic, yeah? And if anyone ever mentions the word SPAC in us as a fund, we're like, okay, thank you. We will call you. Don't worry. But I think just to close this point off, we like getting involved at a very early stage because, as Tim said, we've all been founders of small businesses and we know what the struggling points, we know what the growing pains are, but we can also help them in the more challenging times in being able to scale. And it's a fun journey. We love getting involved, but importantly, we love injecting our own personality and why not a little bit of fun as well in the process.
So speaking of like helping organizations through challenges and the experience that you've had, 2022 was a very difficult year, I would imagine, to be an investor. Markets obviously came back to earth. Access to capital became much more difficult. I'm really curious to understand a little bit better, just if you would summarize the 2022 with all the challenges that it brought. Obviously, Yole Investments is a quite crypto-heavy fund as well, with many crypto investments. Crypto definitely came back to earth. That's definitely not an overstatement. But can you talk about like the challenges that you guys faced last year, how you navigated them, and potentially what were some of the mistakes that you did during the year?
Steve, I can jump in a little bit. I think we are all, at the end of the day, very core believers and supporters of the ecosystem for crypto. And in reality is, I think only a very small percentage of our investments, probably less than 5%, are even exposed to kind of the token impacts and such. I think in general, we prefer to invest into businesses, infra, technology, platform. That being said, I mean, we certainly had our share of, you know, humble pie, and, you know, the more famous ones would be Luna and FTX US. But I think we actually learned quite a bit from those. I think we had the opportunities at the time to enter those deals. And I think the way I would describe it in the word of crypto would be like FOMO, fear of missing out. Right. It's like, all these great minds are in it. We got access. Let's get into it. What it lacked was the first part of what Julian and Tim covered, which is our connection with the founders, with the entrepreneurs, with the people. And I think what we saw, you know, on 2022 was the ones we really did well are ones that we were able to add unfair advantages to, and not just be a financial investor to plant a flag or whatnot. So,
right. Just to follow up on that, I mean, it's very easy in hindsight to say that, like, you know, FTX was a massive mess, and you know, the founder didn't have control over the company. They didn't have like financial controllers. They didn't have a board. All these things. Like, how could anyone invest in them? But it's very easy to say in hindsight, right? As you point out, Steve, these are brilliant minds. They were doing great things and well respected and so on. And as you mentioned, this kind of like FOMO feeling. Is it a real thing amongst institutional investors and big funds, as you mentioned? Is that a big driving factor in such a bull market? And now, absolutely. If you look back at that time, do you have any regrets, perhaps?
I think it's safe to say that every bull market will have its share of FOMO. And institutional investors, as well as retail investors, are not immune to FOMO. We all get the hype. We all get the panic of not being involved. And I think getting there reaches a certain excitement, a certain gambling. We are, after all, also in the gambling industry as well. And I think as GPs, our biggest responsibility is to ensure that we can separate the wheat from the chaff. The truth of the matter is, no matter whether you're an FTX or a startup, you can always hide the stuff. And this is actually where our connection to founders, our connection to their KPIs and their financials is actually really important. Because it helps distill ourselves away from the PR, right? It helps us distill ourselves away from the very crafted narratives and helps us see the real financials underneath. Like, where's your growth rate? How you're supporting your cash flow, what sort of employees are you bringing on board? And the truth of the matter is, at some stage, everybody will pass along the same investor note that's been done by one agency, right? And everybody will want to buy into it. And we, I think as investors, need to make sure that we can remain calm and objective and go through it. Honestly speaking, I think... Sorry, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that a little bit. I think what Tim alluded to earlier, all three of us being entrepreneurs that have built things from scratch, our bullshit radar is frankly better than traditional VCs. I say that openly. And I mean, we also deal with traditional VCs and financial investors as our friends, as our network. But I would say even on the token deals we had exposure to, we did far better than most.
Yeah.
And I think on a net average, you'd be surprised to look at even today, at today's prices, how many are actually surviving and or positive with return multiples on invested capital. There certainly are shares of failures, but yeah.
I think it also represents the stage at which we're in terms of the life cycle. Whereas more mature companies such as FTX would be more leveraged to these kind of changes and imbalances, and they would be caught out on cash liquidity. You don't have that luxury in a startup. When you're in a startup, right, you're dependent on raw stats, and those raw stats are much clearer to an investor. So we'll be able to tell the health check of a startup, right, with much better rigor than, say, a more institutionally advanced company. So that's actually, I think, one of the few advantages of being involved with startups at a very early stage, because it actually helps us understand how healthy a business is, even before you take into account market factors, if that makes sense. Sorry, Tim, I interrupted you.
I was just going to say, like, if we take FTX, when we first got access to the deal, which we thought was amazing that we even had a chance to get access to the deal,
right.
There's Sequoia, there's Lightspeed Ventures, there's probably Tiger Global. There's some big, big boys in there already. And we would assume Sequoia have done extremely good extended due diligence on an asset.
And that's probably what everyone thought, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the guy on Steve's wall there was also invested and certainly hanging around FTX as well. So we almost tried to passport that due diligence through, and we nearly felt embarrassed asking for that. Now, when you start looking at a smaller startup post-revenue, and we know the founders, we sit down to have dinner and a glass of wine with the founders, we get honesty from them, and we get the good, bad, and the ugly. And I think that's the important – if they're willing to open themselves up to us – about the whole business, it allows us to really not judge them at all, but we're in this together to help grow this. And sometimes some difficult feedback is a good thing. But when you get to an FTX stage, it's very, very difficult to even, we never talked to Sam. We were talking to another guy there, and that was, we felt privileged enough to be there. So it was completely FOMO. There's no doubt about it. And you know what? We've learned a really, really good lesson. But what I want to say about venture capital, it's very much like playing poker. And guess what? We all play poker on this channel, on this call. You don't win every flush draw you go for. All you need to do is win 65, 70% of the hands you're putting your money into for a good ROI at the end of the day, and then wait for that one big pot. But knowing when to fold the hand is equally as important. But if you don't play, if you don't enter the hand, you're not going to win the tournament. And I think we need to have some fails. We need to be open and honest with those failures we've had and understand where they've gone wrong so we can learn for the next hand we're playing or the next investment we're making. We don't go all in on a bluff. We are calculating our risk versus reward and learning from it every single time. And then the key to our equation is then bringing that ecosystem of investments together to actually cross-pollinate the B2C operator with the slots company, and actually we're the trusted value glue in between them that I can say, oh, meet him, meet them. You guys should do a deal, and this is a deal you should do because it's fair for both parties. And we actually remove all the bullshit and just say, go and make business. And there's that trusted sort of relationship there, which allows businesses to prosper. And I think that's the most important thing of our venture capital adventure. We are learning every single day where we best fit and how we can best get return on investment for ourselves and for our LPs as well, who have invested in us to make them money, which is what we enjoy doing.
So Tim, has your investment thesis changed now based on the experiences in 2020, 2021, and 2022 when the markets were different and you went through these kind of mistakes in 2022, so to say? Do you view investment differently now?
Not really. I don't think FTX was a mistake. On paper, it was the darling of the industry. Right. And I think they got too greedy in about June last year. They got tied up in the Luna fiasco as well. Basically tried to leverage and cover a position by leveraging the FTT tokens, which had no inherent value. If they weren't greedy, it would be a very successful exchange. There's no doubt about it, and probably would be the darling of the industry moving forward, except they were always tangling with CZ and Binance and whatnot. So I don't think their business model was wrong. I think they got greedy in terms of how do they make money out of thin air, and did that without being transparent to their shareholders or their board or their employees or the market in general.
I think regardless.
Not a bad investment, yeah.
I think regardless, Pierre, our investment thesis hasn't really changed, and for a couple of reasons. One, our exposure to what we call, let's say, more risky assets such as FTX actually was quite minimal. So actually, we didn't really take a hit as a VC. I think it's more
half a percent of our asset portfolio.
And that's actually because, as Tim said, we don't go all in on investments, no matter how good it looks, no matter if we think it's actually the next PayPal, right? But I think more importantly, we actually have quite a deleveraged set of investments and on quantums. And we have a really good view in terms of risk. So if something sounds and smells too good to be true, it probably is. There's probably something wrong with it. So we actually take a step back and unwind, or at the very least, take a position with an option to invest down the line. So I think in that regard, call it luck, call it previous experience on being burnt on other assets, I think we have a much more risk cautious approach. And in fact, our crypto exposure last year was less on assets that depended on the underlying price of crypto, but more on the underlying trade. And as we know, any assets that last year that traded crypto did a lot of money, because actually the volume increased last year, which actually is good for us as investors, if that makes sense.
Right. It makes sense. Steve?
Yeah, last thing to add on the FTX topic is also that deal gave us a seat and access to a whole broader network of investors that for all our other 80 to 100 subsequent deals, when it comes time to show all the equal people that have lost money on this deal, we all lost money on, to show them, hey, you want to see a deal to make money on? And you know, these are the 10, 20, 30 companies for them to dabble into and get exposure on. So,
right. Yeah. It's an interesting perspective. It's not only about the investment, but it's also getting a foot in the door and creating a network that then leads to further interesting investments in the space, for sure. Another question, just to switch topic a little bit. Now, as we look forward into 2023, economists are debating whether we are entering a much more difficult year ahead, potential recession due to the interest rates increasing constantly. What's YOLO Investments' view on the economy 2023? Do you see a contracting economy? How will that affect the investment landscape? Are you taking a more cautious approach, or do you perhaps have a totally different view than what I'm outlining here? Julian?
I'll take the macro view. We haven't called the bottom yet, let's be clear. So there's going to be more risks, there's going to be more pitfalls, and importantly, there's going to be more haircuts in valuation. So I think as GPs, we need to be cognizant of the fact that this year will be a turbulence, if not more than last year. In terms of our portfolio, in terms of our investments, we actually tend to be more bullish, because actually we get investments at a very early stage in their life cycle, so they wouldn't be overhyped, right? Where the risks come in is when you do need a funding round this year, and that's where you need to be more measured and more balanced. It's better to go in for a more pragmatic round of funding this year at a lower valuation, because then you can get the benefits of the upswing when everybody gets into a bullish market. So I think in terms of our investment strategy, we would invest, across fewer assets, but then the assets that we do pick would then tend to be the winners that are emerging from this this consolidation of the market, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Just two, three sentences on the global macro thing. I think everybody's waiting for China to open up and then to have a proper growth path, okay? Without that, then the only, workhorse that is dragging the global economy is potentially the United States. Nothing else is really making a dent on global GDP. They may have pockets of growth, but if you're talking about the global GDP, which we're all a part of, and under the same pressures of liquidity and global interest rates and monetary policies, then the biggest catalyst for growth or a continuation of a drag, in my opinion, is going to be how China opens up with this COVID situation, with the global economic situation. And then the second biggest one, obviously, is the war in Europe over there between Russia and Ukraine. I think that has a huge macro overhang issue. And then how military and military industrial complex type of stuff, somebody's making money. So
That's for sure. So, yeah. Steve, just to linger on this a little bit. Sorry, Tim. Steve, you mentioned China and Canada and how they will affect the global markets. Looking at Alibaba, for example, you can see over the last couple of months, they have been doing really well on the stock markets, up something like 60-70%, especially the last couple of weeks, they are up like 30% on the markets. And I suppose from an investment point of view, what investors are scared of in regards to China is that some of these publicly traded companies may be delisted from stock markets, and the Chinese government takes a much more kind of cautious approach.
Yeah, what
do you think?
So my reference point was not to any of the stocks or stock markets of the China companies, but more about how the growth of the China economy might impact the other companies, whether they be Mercedes, Microsoft,
right.
You know, and then that the cascading impact of that, even tourism as an industry, even leisure, which ultimately is the industry of gaming, that, you know, as Macau opens up or stays closed, it impacts our industry. As the Chinese tourist goes out, that impacts our industry. So,
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose the Chinese government has been hasn't been consistent enough for investors and its economy to feel confident enough. For example, what's going to happen in Macau is very difficult to say because of the inconsistencies by the Chinese
government.
Trust
me when I say the Chinese government does not give a damn about outside investors. does not occupy 0.01% of their mindset.
Okay, fair enough. Tim, sorry, I cut you off.
My view on the current trends of 2023, it's more about who we're investing into and what opportunities are coming to the table. Yeah. I think right now the whole industry has said that's enough investments during a bull run. Let's buckle down and work hard, roll the sleeves up, and let's build these businesses what we have and really try and make them successful. How do we, you know, limit spending? Because in a bull market, everyone seems to want to spend more and more money, and they don't really control it. Like, you know, I built a business from a dollar, and I had to control every single dollar for coming in and going out. And I think you've got to learn sort of that hard work narrative sometimes of some of these businesses. I think you're right. When they are getting harder, the valuations will come down to what should be a proper valuation for their current status, as opposed to what's a FOMO inflated valuation of what it might well be. So we're being a lot more picky on what we're getting into, coming back down to absolute first principles and fundamentals, and really taking a look at who are the people behind this business, what have they done, what have they failed on, what have they done well, and can they replicate that and do it even better with this new product or company they're making. And can they do it on a sensible budget and preserve their cash flow, as opposed to just reaching out and saying, uncle, can I get some more money, please? Because that money is now being turned off for the next 12, 18 months.
I have a saying nowadays that all businesses that we look at fall into category A, category B. Category A, companies that make money. Category B, companies that's really good at raising money. If you don't belong in either box, you're going bankrupt. Like, I mean, if you're not good at raising money and you don't know how to make money, you're going to die. Right? So,
Steve, can I ask you about that more? So there's kind of like two ways to build a company, I suppose. One of which is to grow top line, which then enables you to increase your valuation, which then enables you to raise capital, which then enables you to invest in your top line.
That I would put in category two.
That's
that I would put in category two.
Is that a sustainable way in 2023 to run a business, do you think? Or is it all about the bottom line now?
No, it's not all about the bottom line. Revenue, top line growth definitely matters, but underneath it, there ought to be a scalable unit economic margin. Okay, so you can make like say a penny, but you decide to spend more to keep on growing that top line. There's a scalable model. At a certain point, it will reach a cash flow break even point. It might be 5 years from now. It might be 10 years from now. Whatever. But if you're, and there's a lot of cases where they're literally spending $10 to buy $8 of revenue, all right? Mm-hmm. Those ones,
Gone.
Best example is if you look at the EV on EBITDA ratios, right, across all public markets. So we pour over these analyst reports all day long, right? And we have a great team of investment analysts behind us that do this. If you look at the EV on EBITDA ratios, they've been coming steadily down, right, for the last year. And we expect them to continue going down. What does that mean? It means that valuations will be based less on multiples of turnover, but more on multiples of profit, but importantly, also free cash flow. So as Tim said, right, we will actually start seeing more realistic valuations coming down to earth. But then based on what Steve said, we will actually be able to see then the rise based on the ability of those companies to then pivot, right, to say, look, guys, we've actually preserved our cash flows during the winter season, but look at us now. We're able now to scale up, right, bring our sales force out into the world, bring our product more to market. And based on that, now we can get more pragmatic valuations. I think from Yolo Investments, I think we're relatively shielded from I would call the noise, because our valuations are grounded with startups. Startups don't have the luxury of being able to boast about 100 times revenue, right, or 15 times EBITDA. They are small startups, right, which most of them have been built on a dollar, right, and actually are very frugal in terms of how they can control, whether they can justify the expenses to go on a sales trip, right, to a conference. We like those businesses, right, because there's actually less fluff at the top, less human capital in the middle, but then a very tangible product at the bottom. And then we put all our resources, both in terms of capital, but also our domain knowledge behind them, if that makes sense.
To add to Julian's point, our domain knowledge in our industry that we're talking about here in terms of iGaming, it gives us intelligence to say, what should a supplier look like? What should an operator and a brand look like? What should be a platform look like? Okay, it's hard for somebody to pitch us, well, we're going to keep on making revenue, and then just please give us a 20x on that revenue, because, you know, Uncle Bob is giving us that valuation. You know, we've seen enough of it. We have enough grit, enough blood, enough scars in this space. All four of us do that. You know, we have a better sense of reality versus, yeah, like, let's say a California investor looking at the latest casino tech and, you know, giving it an excessive valuation.
Right. No. Looking at
which
the
we should,
TAM,
which we should introduce to all our deals, by the way.
The TAM is the amount of thing. One thing I love that we do, you know, I think we're invested in 8 slot companies now. We actually look at that product life cycle, and we look at the metrics around how much a slot game costs to make, what a good launch of a slot game takes, how long should go to QA, how long should go to certification, how long should go in the, you know, making the first 100,000 turnover, whatever it is. And we can not necessarily, here's all open books of all our companies, but we can say, this is the benchmark on those 6 points of the journey. Here you are, or here you are. And that identifies Absolutely. What they need to work on and improve. And it's the coolest thing, because it's nothing difficult. It's just saying, this is what others are doing on an anonymized basis. This is where you're at. That's what you need to fix. If you can fix that cost of building a slot from 50,000 down to 35, now look at the revenue you're going to make. If you get that distribution, you're making money. It's really simple.
Yeah. All right. Just to turn the coin around, I mean, from a founder's perspective, now how do you navigate the situation as it is now in the economy, where, again, previously it was kind of the founder's market, where it was easy to access capital as long as you had a kind of like a half okay idea and some motivation and a good reputation. But today, like in your guys' experience, you deal with so many founders, and I'm sure you've seen all the mistakes. I'm sure you've seen all the successes. Is there any kind of like red thread in the founders that you guys see in how they choose to build organizations or as well?
I'll go first on this one. If times get hard and a founder or a management team say, we just need to raise more money, that's a red flag. I want to say, first of all, this is how we're going to make money. Because if you can make money in a bad environment, I think Jordan said before, you can make a lot more money in a bull market. So I don't want the founders taking the easy way out saying, oh, if we just raise more money, we have this in the pipeline that's going to work. I want to see them actually go and do 12 hours a day and show that they can make a positive EBITDA on even on a small scale, and show us the model works and get that revenue in, and then worry about the fluff elsewhere. But if the first thing is, oh shit, we're out of money, we need to raise more money, let's spend months and months on doing all the pitch decks and the investor meetings and the roadshows, they're not building a business. And that's what I look at, especially just personally.
Yeah. I look, from a founder's perspective, it's very easy to lose sight of the ball. If you're continually looking to raise capital, as opposed to actually seeing how you're going to expand your product, take it to market, hire the best talent in the industry, that's normally a red flag for us. Our best indicators, the green flags, are actually founders who are unwavered by any macro circumstances and are just intent on pushing out their product to the market. That's normally someone and entities that we normally back. But importantly, we push our support and our operational cost too. And it also means that these founders are typically well-weathered people who are grounded in reality, right? And don't believe that they are bigger than the business they represent. And that's something that we actually have. We've got this unspoken rule called the no dickhead policy, right? Which actually happens in the very first meeting, which is why us as GPs, we take the first call when an investment happens. We need to understand that we can see eye to eye with investors, but importantly, these investors are grounded in reality. We've backed some of the best early stage startups in both fintech and in gaming, purely based on this ideal. Because we've been founders, we've been penniless, we've reached points where we couldn't raise capital. So we need to be able to understand that taste of failure and actually see it in other founders. And if other founders have it, and they can tell us about their war stories, but importantly, show a level-headed of pragmatism and understated entrepreneurship, so we know they are great people without them actually telling us, then we normally have a winner. Because when circumstances like what we're having in the outside world right now are facing, we know these people will persevere. This is what picks the winners, and we're hoping we're backing some of those winners right today.
Amazing. I love that. Go ahead, Tim.
There's an interesting one. I love it. When you get a pitch deck in, sometimes people make this most beautiful presentation and it's 60 pages of graphs and this and that and blah, 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 blah. Others come in, it's a one-pager. This is the problem. This is our solution. This is what we need to do to achieve that solution. And this is what we think it can do. And you know what? Those 10 dot points are enough to invest on. Because 60 pages don't mean shit to me. Sorry.
I was going to ask that. How important is the pitch deck? How long do you look at the pitch deck on average?
3 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to see how the person.
It's like writing a CV.
Can I identify the problem, and then can I identify a solution to the problem? Hmm. How are they thinking through that? That's all I want to see out of it.
Yeah,
it makes sense. Just to your point here, I've been following Yolo for a long time, and this no dickhead policy is a good and interesting policy. And I wanted to enlighten the dear GPs of a very good litmus test that you can do in order to find out if someone is indeed a dickhead. Have you heard about the shopping cart litmus test? I suppose not. Okay. So the best way to find out if someone is a dickhead is, you know, when you go to the shopping mall and you have the cart that you drive the groceries with. This is a very interesting scenario because when you go out to the car park and you put your groceries into your car, you have two choices with the shopping cart. Either you can return it where it's supposed to be, or you can leave it where it's like that. Leaving it is fine. You're not going to go to prison. No one is going to say anything bad against you. You'll be fine. But you know that morally, the right thing to do is to leave the shopping cart where it's supposed to be, in its right place. So my suggestion to the dear GPs of Yolo Investment here today is whenever you are considering an investment, take the founder out to shopping. And see what they do with the shopping cart. And from there, you can take a hard decision whether you want to invest in the company or not.
There's a third option there's a third person in that scenario, Pierre. It's a person going around collecting 10 shopping carts, putting them all back in and taking the 20 cents from each of them and making money out of it. That's the guy I'm going
to back. That's the one. That's the one you want to find, yeah. I love that. So just as a final question here today, like if you now look into 2023, I mean, a potential recession, how's that going to impact the Agami industry, crypto, so on and so forth? Like, are there any specific opportunities that you guys are looking for at the moment? Is there any opportunities that you see in the industry that are specifically interesting? Any trends that you're looking at, so on and so forth?
The biggest opportunity I'm seeing right now, this is a little bit kind of reverse. We've been investing since 2017, and a lot of companies have come to fruition and have exited, and those founders have now got liquid cash, liquid wealth. I've found a lot of people have been coming to me saying, we've done it once, this is fantastic, we've got this money, what do we do now? Can we invest into Yolo Investments and become a mentor of and a part of that ecosystem, as a mentor, part of that ecosystem, as an LP, limited partner, and work with you, Tim and Julian and Steve, on investing in the next round of startups? I think right now that's the opportunity, because there are very, very good deals out there if you can find them, and building that network around you. But yeah, we're getting a lot of inquiries about, you know, we've re-domiciled ourselves to Guernsey now under a regulated fund, simply because there's more and more people wanting to invest into what we're doing and come on our journey with us, and not just put the money in and be silent, but actually be, as I said, a mentor. And I think it's a really exciting role for a founder who's had that exit to then still get their feet wet, but without all the HR and policies and processes and all that crap that you're going to go through, but really the essence of making a business. And we're really enjoying that kind of network of mentors that we're building around us as well. That's the opportunity, in my view.
Look, 2023 is quite an exciting year for us, particularly because we know that there's going to be a lot of consolidation and, in so doing, M&A activity. And we've already started to receive what essentially are bear hugs from would-be bigger buyers wanting to buy some of our more prized investments. It's a challenge for us, because our biggest challenge is to ensure we can stave off our investments and their valuation as long as possible. But for us, it's exciting because we know we're reaching the end of a journey for some of our investments that are going to reach what essentially is a very valuable liquidity event. So for us, it's going to be a great year. We're looking at it with, let's say, cautious optimism, because we know that it's going to be a year of downsize corrections, more bust ups, but importantly, more failures. But we also see a lot of M&A activity as well. And some of our assets that we've been holding to for a while, we know we're actually going to be reaching some very exciting liquidity events for them, if that makes sense.
I think the three areas that we discussed, fintech, awesome. Most of the world remains unbanked, okay? And banks, traditional ones, plainly suck. So for us, us having an ability to disrupt into that, both as a supplier, operator, investor, is tremendously interesting for us in multiple markets and multiple populations across the world. iGaming, massive. There is nobody who has done everything right everywhere. So whether you have a great product that we can invest into, there are so many markets and operators we can bring to. And likewise, if you're an operator or platform, there's so many things we can help on, both on the payment side and also the supplier side, and also on the operating side in terms of experiences. Now, the trickiest one to answer would be crypto. And the way I would answer is crypto done right. Like, and this goes into some basic business stuff. Like, does it make, what operational efficiencies does it provide? So for crypto that is done right, okay, not just because people want to get in and get rich, I think those opportunities will hopefully be double massive. But, you know, that's what we're looking and peeling and looking for. So,
yep.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, guys. This has been a brilliant first episode of YOLO Unleashed, and I'm certainly very excited now throughout the year to interview some of the founders that belong within the YOLO Investment Group. Thank you guys for giving me your time, and I will see you, I suppose, in the parking garage looking for the next generation of founders. Yeah. Thank you so much, guys.
I was stopping colleagues. Thanks, Pierre.
Thank you, Pierre.
Thanks, Pierre.
Thank you.